Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Fifth Division, the Honorable Justice Mathias W. Delort presiding, case number 19-1905, People versus Marvin Treadwell.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, Fifth Division. We'll ask that the lawyers who are going to argue on the case today please introduce themselves and tell us whom you represent, beginning with the appellant.
So my name is Deborah Pugh of the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I represent Marvin Treadwell.
And for the state?
Good afternoon, Assistant State's Attorney Sarah McGann on behalf of the people.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. We'll allot about 15 minutes for each side. We may extend that if we have a lot of questions. As you know, please remember that we have read the briefs and are familiar with the facts of the case. With that, Ms. Pugh, you may begin when ready.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal as well.
Yes, we'll give you 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Okay, thank you. So I would like to focus today on the first issue regarding Chester Slaughter and also counsel choice, as well as to talk briefly about the third issue involving the sleeping judge. But obviously, I'm happy to take questions on either of the other two issues. So the Illinois Supreme Court's order here was clear. It granted Chester Slaughter a stay of his suspension to, quote, allow completion of pending murder trial. That trial was not Marvin Treadwell's, even though his trial was set to begin just days later. It was only for the unrelated trial of David White. Chester Slaughter was not authorized to represent Marvin Treadwell during this time. He sought and received permission only to represent David White. And to whatever degree this court finds that it was a general stay, not specifically for David White, that stay was received through fraud. At the time of the suspension, Slaughter had been representing Treadwell, who was being charged with a murder that occurred when he was 17 years old for 4 years. Treadwell's trial was set for October 18th, 2004. And in September, the Illinois Supreme Court ordered Slaughter's suspension to begin on October 15th, 3 days before Treadwell's trial was to begin. And he was being suspended for an issue of moral turpitude, that he had given false and misleading information in a credit application, multiple credit applications.
Ms. Pugh, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. So what, I think we all recognize that the Supreme Court granted his motion specifically for Defendant White. What are you alleging was the negative impact of Mr. Slaughter trying the case on behalf of Treadwell when he wasn't specifically authorized to do that? I think we can all agree that that was a fact, but what was the result of that? Do you think the result would have been different had he asked for permission to try the case for Mr. Treadwell?
Well, that is sort of jumping to the case law involved here. That's sort of the question of whether or not it's required to choose to prove prejudice. And so in cases like the Illinois Supreme Court case Brigham, if somebody is not authorized to practice law, if it is related to a small technical error, like the failure to pay ARDC fees or something like that, then you do have to show prejudice, that it's not a per se error. However, if it's something that actually relates to your abilities as a lawyer in terms of your moral turpitude or your ability to practice law, then it's not necessary to show prejudice. And so the question that you're asking sort of makes the assumption that it's necessary to show prejudice, but the case law really assumes that it's not necessary to show prejudice, including there aren't many cases in Illinois about this for obvious reasons, that it's not that common that someone is practicing law, certainly not in this very strange circumstance, but even in general. But when you look to federal cases like Novak or Salinas, if you're talking about somebody who's practicing law, who's not licensed to do so for a reason of moral turpitude, that he was found to have been giving false and misleading information, he gave false and misleading information to the Illinois Supreme Court.
Well, let me ask you, you say not licensed, I guess you're using it in an analogous way, but he was licensed.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, yes, he was licensed at that time. It was suspended, okay. And it wasn't.
And that leads to the question is, is there such a thing as being sort of partially suspended? Is there a case on that? Because the Supreme Court basically unsuspended him. And, you know, there is a comment in the order that is regarding a pending murder trial without referring to which one or which ones. But Is there something that's like a partial suspension? Because that's what you're advocating here.
I've been looking into this and I can't find any cases about it, but what I found was that if you look in the common law record on pages 605 and 607, so it's on 605 and 607 in the common law record, what we have is a documentation about his previous suspension, which also occurred while he was representing Treadwell. And for that, he was given a general stay. And so that there's on page 605, it says that the stay was, he was stayed entirely by a period of probation or state, and then on 607, the actual order says that it was stayed in full. So to me, that sort of indicates that the language in the order was not surplusage, that this was, he sought and received it for solely to represent White. But I want to stress that even if this court finds that that was a general stay, because again, the case law is not clear. We can only go by what the language actually says in the on the order and to sort of
My question is similar to Justice DeLorte's, but a little bit more narrow. If the Supreme Court lifted the suspension and allowed him to practice, is there licensure just for one case? I mean, that's kind of what your argument is, that if they've listed the suspension and stayed the suspension and allowed him to practice. It goes back to Justice DeLorte's question of, is there partial licensure? I think he said partial suspension, but I'm asking, is there partial licensure? So you're just licensed just for this one case, and anything else, the license doesn't extend outside the parameters of that one case. Seems to me that that's what your argument is. And
well, it's really, I mean, I've been looking into the rules and the Supreme Court rules about this. I mean, I don't know what the actual answer is. I don't know what powers the Illinois Supreme Court has regarding it. I mean, this sort of goes to the idea that an evidentiary hearing would be necessary to sort of even figure out what the nature of the suspension was, because we're sort of grasping at trying to figure out what actually were his, I don't know what the Illinois Supreme Court is able to do.
I don't know that that's what the, that's not my question, because I think we can assume that when the Supreme Court says you're suspended from the practice of law, that means you can't practice law. It's not that you can practice it a little bit or you can practice it sometimes. It means you can't practice law. So I think that that's my understanding of the plain meaning of that phrase. And my question is much more narrow. Are you advocating that by granting a stay, the stay only applies to Mr. White and anything outside of that is not licensed, because the license is suspended? The fact is, when you have a suspended license, it's like you don't have a license for that period of time of the suspension. So I'm trying to understand your argument with respect to the stay and how that applies or doesn't apply to Mr. Treadwell.
Just looking at the language in the actual order, that is my argument, but I understand that this is a very strange situation and I don't know whether the Illinois Supreme Court normally does that at all. And so because there's just no case law on this and the rules don't really give us much guidance either, but that is that's what Slaughter was seeking and that's what Slaughter received. And so we're sort of left with a question there about what the Illinois Supreme Court actually meant when they said for the pending murder case. But I do want to talk about what actually was in that motion, and that even if we do say this was a general stay, there's no such thing as a limited stay. Even if you were to find that, this stay was obtained through fraud. It's very difficult to imagine that had the Illinois Supreme Court understood the level of misleading information that he was providing here, while he was already being suspended for providing false and misleading information, this one short document is rife with misleading statements. He says that he was making arrangements for other attorneys to handle his other cases. Of course, we know that's not true, because we know that Judge Dernbach didn't even allow him to withdraw, which we'll talk about counsel of choice. He says that he was also working on finishing up his other cases so that he wouldn't be working on anything but David White. But we also know that that's not true, because Treadwell's trial was supposed to start 3 days after the suspension would begin, and he made no effort to move it up earlier so that it would be occurring before the suspension. And there's also a line that he uses in the motion for the suspension that's really interesting, and I didn't highlight it in my brief, but it's on page 453, and it's paragraph 4. He says, Slaughter says, if the state completes its case and the defendant is found not guilty on that date, meaning if David White is found not guilty on October 12th, respondent would be prepared to begin his suspension as ordered. So he knows that he has this first degree murder trial for Treadwell coming up just days after that. The suspension would be starting on the 15th. And so what does he mean? What would he even be doing? Is he saying that he would then just not show up? Would he say would he be practicing without a license for sure then? He does have a general stay, it was obtained through fraud and through further moral turpitude. And again, there aren't that many cases about people obtaining a stay through
fraud. Counsel, can I ask you a question? As far as Mr. Slaughter is concerned, didn't he ask a number of times to withdraw from the case and the court would not allow it?
What happened was, this is sort of moving on to the second part about counsel of choice. What happened was, so Slaughter had not shown up at Treadwell's trial for a year. And then, so on February 4th, 2004, Treadwell said to Judge Reyna, who'd been overseeing the case for 4 years, said, I'd like to fire Slaughter and be appointed a public defender. And Judge Reyna, who'd been seeing what Slaughter had been doing and not doing, said, absolutely, let's get Slaughter out of here. Let's get you a public defender. But then over the next couple of weeks, he went before several different judges because there had been, he had a co-defendant and there were some substitution of judge things going on. So then he went before Judge Claps, who says, yes, absolutely, new public defender, but we need to get Slaughter in here. But then you've got to get your public defender up to speed. Then he goes before Judge Tooman, who says, yes, absolutely. Like, I respect Judge Reyna's order. You get a public defender, but I want you to be before the judge that you're going to be permanently in front of. Then on March 12th, so just 5 weeks after Judge Reyna had granted his motion to fire Slaughter, Judge Sternbach shows up and apparently had not even glanced at what had happened at the last hearing that he'd had with Judge Reyna. And Slaughter shows up and he asks to withdraw. He doesn't admit that he's been fired, that Judge Reyna had agreed that he should be fired, that he could be fired, and that the other judges had obviously supported that. And instead, he just says, well, they're not paying me. He complained about not being paid
Didn't this complicate things that the court made that ruling and forced him to stay in when the idea was to let him go?
Well, it complicates things in the sense that he didn't admit that he'd been fired, which so representing someone without even admitting that you've been fired and then asking for money. And then Judge Sternbach, I mean, a counsel of choice is an absolute right. And Treadwell's motion had already been granted. So Treadwell was denied his counsel of choice. But going back to this is something that he should have, going just circling back to the motion for the stay. If this is true that Judge Sternbach did not let him withdraw, why isn't he mentioning this? It does complicate things, and it complicates things so much that he hid it from the Illinois Supreme Court. The Illinois Supreme Court, who had already suspended him once for neglecting criminal matters, would not want, he was trying to hide from the Illinois Supreme Court that another defendant was trying to fire him and that he denied it. He did not admit that he'd been fired. And in fact, he tried to get money from him. He tried to get appointed. So he's hiding this. So it adds to the fraud. It just says that yes, he was denied. He wasn't allowed that Judge Sternbach, having not read the record, denied Treadwell the right to counsel of choice. And then he doesn't reveal that to the Illinois Supreme Court. This is a very serious document that he's filing with the Illinois Supreme Court about his own suspension. And he's leaving out everything about the representation of Treadwell in order to get this little suspension for this one case that then, you know, whether or not it even applies to Treadwell is really unclear, because they do know how to do a general stay if they want to do a general stay. And this does not say a general stay.
Yeah, counsel, in a simple answer, I know Justice Cunningham already asked you, what's the prejudice? Tell us the prejudice.
Well, the point about this in this case is that if you look at Bingham, if you look at Gamino, if you look at the federal cases like Novak and Salinas, you don't have to show prejudice in a case like this to have to be represented by someone who is not properly licensed, either due to fraud, which he did commit. I don't think that there's any argument that he was purposely leaving out essential information and that he's misrepresenting his intentions to the Illinois Supreme Court. If you're not properly licensed, if you are licensed due to fraud, or if you're not properly licensed, you're not a real lawyer. And that there, you don't have to show prejudice. Bingham talks about, Bingham goes the other way because that just involves ARDC fees. But when you look at Brigham, it really shows that in a case like this, this is where you don't actually have to show prejudice. It's very hard to show prejudice about how would you show that this person who was engaging in this kind of moral turpitude, how it affect this is an issue of engaging involving the judicial integrity and the judicial process. And so in these cases, you don't show prejudice because it's a per se error. And so that's
because your time is almost up here. So let me ask you, what is the relief you're requesting? Are you requesting for a fresh second stage hearing with an amended petition, perhaps, or are we going to a third stage? I'm a little unclear on exactly what you're asking us to do.
I think in general, the Illinois Supreme Court in these cases does not want you to skip a step. And so while I believe strongly that this should be a third stage hearing, I think that truly to follow, to go absolutely by the books, it should go back for second stage, in which counsel will then amend the petition in order to include these issues. So then the state has a chance to respond and the judge can rule on it. And then
and if we are amending the petition back at the second stage again on a remand, does the defendant have the right to amend the second stage petition at the second stage to include anything, or just the issues that are sort of floating out there right now?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think in this case, that's maybe an academic point, because I'm not sure that there are any other issues that are floating around, because the sleeping issue's already been, but I would think that would be within this court's right to say you could only amend these issues that we've found to be proper.
Okay. And who was the judge who was allegedly sleeping? Was that Ralph Reyna?
No, it was Judge Dernbach.
Okay.
Yeah, Dennis Dernbach.
I'll give you a couple more minutes to address anything else you want to address and see if we have more questions from the panel.
The sleeping issue involves three affidavits that have to be taken as true. And so this is something that would really need to be developed at a third stage hearing. And so I think I'm just going to leave that and say this really requires a third stage hearing. As I just want to stress counsel of choice for a second, just to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court Gonzalez-Lopez that talks about, this is Justice Scalia really stressing the importance that defendants have an absolute right to counsel of choice. It's one of the tiny, tiny handful of errors that are considered federal structural errors. And Treadwell's right to counsel of choice was denied. The state says that the state places the blame entirely on Treadwell, saying that he personally failed to follow through with a pending motion for a new lawyer. But that's not true. There was no pending motion. The motion had been granted, and says that it was Treadwell's fault that Judge Dernbach ignored Judge Reyna's rulings. Well, the previous two judges didn't ignore Judge Reyna's ruling, and Judge Dernbach had a responsibility to know what was going on. And this is not like minutia of things that happened years before. This is what happened 5 weeks before, on the very last court date that Judge Reyna, who had been overseeing it for 4 years, this was the last day. This is not a roll up your sleeves, really, you know, get out your magnifying glass. This is right there. And this is in this, and nobody in the courtroom spoke up for Treadwell. And the state doesn't even argue that it was done, that the request for a new lawyer was done for purposes of delay. That's the only way a motion for a new lawyer can be denied, if it's for purposes of delay. But here Treadwell did it for the opposite reason. He wanted the case to move on. He asked for a new lawyer after Slaughter had not shown up for a year. So I just really want to stress, I know I'm out of time, I just really want to stress, the counsel of choice issue is a very powerful issue. It's an extremely important issue for the integrity of the judicial system that the U.S. Supreme Court cares enormously about, the Illinois Supreme Court cares enormously about. Here the motion was granted, but then it was ignored. And so this should go back again for second stage in order for it to be added to the petition. But this is the kind of issue that I would hope would really get this court's attention, because this is quite serious. And so if this court has no further questions, I'll wait for my rebuttal.
Any other questions from the panel?
No.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pugh. Ms. McGann, you may proceed when ready. We'll give you approximately the same amount of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. Your Honors, if we could just go back a little bit here and just point out that post-conviction counsel did file a, you know, Rule 651C certificate. So that created this rebuttable presumption that he provided reasonable assistance. And I think counsel glossed over that, and we went right to the heart of the issue here. But the reality is that, you know, counsel, albeit his initial counsel, did meet with defendant or discuss with defendant all of his claims and shaped the claims that counsel felt would adequately present, petitioner's constitutional deprivations.
Ms. McGann, could we speak to the issue about the suspension of Mr. Slaughter's license and the fact that he neglected to tell the Illinois Supreme Court that he had an upcoming murder trial, and therefore your opponent's point that he was basically committing a fraud by representing Mr. Treadwell when he knew very well that he had been suspended. Can you speak to that issue? I'm much more concerned about that than the 651 issue.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think I only pointed that out because there was no per se, viable per se ineffective assistance of counsel claim here. So that's why that was not presented. And that's because we do have Mr. Slaughter, admitting to the Supreme Court that he has this white murder trial, but we also have, and we see this in the memo, that he has other pending matters here. So, and it's, maybe it is minutia, but the white trial was commenced and continued for the state to bring in other witnesses. There was some uncertainty about, where that was headed, and that perhaps the sentencing date would be much further.
Let me ask you this. He did go on to later represent Mr. Treadwell without going back. Couldn't he have gone back to the Supreme Court on another motion? And then we wouldn't be here, would we? I mean, it would be clear. No, you are still suspended and you may not represent that defendant, or since the trial is so imminent, go ahead. I mean, wouldn't that have been the thing to do?
Certainly, and I'm all about that Monday morning quarterbacking in all aspects of my life. Here, he did not do it. And yes, here we are now.
Well, I take umbrage with calling that. That's just good lawyering. And I think he's required to do that. If you're suspended by the Illinois Supreme Court, which is the ultimate authority on the practice of law mm-hmm. in this state, and they say you're suspended, seems to me that most lawyers, or every lawyer who wants to practice, would say, oh, I better ask the court for leave to stay this. So I wouldn't call that Monday morning quarterbacking. I think it's good lawyering.
Certainly. And yes, and so I'm not going to speak to his caliber, but what he did front was that he had a murder trial and other pending matters. So he didn't only solely focus on the white murder trial, although it's certainly highlighted in the most prevalent paragraph there, but he admits that he's working on other pending matters.
Wait a minute, are you saying that the leave that he sought from the Supreme Court was more general than white, and he was generally seeking leave to continue representing clients whose cases were imminent? That's not the takeaway I got from reading the substance of what he was seeking. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying he does mention that he has other pending matters. So no, I'm certainly not saying that he is asking for, this stay so that he can work on Treadwell. But the fact remains that he was still duly licensed. He was not suspended when he represented Treadwell at trial. So that fact remains. And so
let me ask you, I'm sorry for interrupting, but I want to get to that's the same point I asked your opponent. So you're saying there was no prejudice? Is that your contention? Ms. Pugh said that it was prejudice per se because he was suspended. He knew he was suspended. He obtained leave by fraud, and the leave that he obtained wasn't even for this particular defendant. It was for somebody else. So as far as she's concerned, that's prejudice. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that there was no prejudice because we don't have an argument here presenting any prejudice, but if counsel was able and allowed to represent White, which was also a murder trial, so, this level of severity, the same here with Treadwell, I can't say that there was any prejudice. In fact, he had been representing him for 4 years and he was not disbarred. He was not suspended at this time. And so without knowing what the argument for prejudice would be, no, he wasn't. He was represented and the trial went through with without a hitch, if you will. But here we are now in hindsight, focusing on what he represented to the Supreme Court, the fraudulent nature there, which I just want to add in, you know, his suspension, I'm not going to downplay it at all, but it was based on, you know, financial misrepresentations. So if we're really going to dig deep here, I'm not sure that we can extract prejudice from what his suspension was based on. And I don't want to speculate in any way, but there's not a direct correlation. So yes, while he may have, you know, error by omission by not asking for the Supreme Court to sanction Treadwell, you know, per se, I don't think that we can deny that he remained licensed and he remained an attorney active with the Illinois bar. And that's never more apparent because he did actually proceed on the White case. It's certainly, you know, difficult facts here. And I'm not, you know, trying to speak for Mr.
Sir, I have to ask you, Ms. McGann, wasn't he suspended in September of 04?
He was suspended. There was. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have his previous suspensions. But yes, there were previous ones.
That's the information I have.
Yes.
But the trial went forward in October of 04. And he was only allowed to practice for the trial, the White trial. Isn't that true? Do you dispute that?
I think that is what the Supreme Court sanctioned, yes, when they responded to his memo. But I can't, I can't find, you know, I just don't know where the argument is that he was only licensed for that case, especially where he did front and address that he did have other pending matters. I don't deny that he was not upfront about the Treadwell case. I'm sorry.
Ms. McGann, that's not the argument that I extrapolated from what your opponent, Ms. Pugh, said. She didn't say that he was just licensed for that. She said that it's, if you are licensed specifically, this is what my takeaway, and she can respond later. If the Supreme Court license gave him a stay for that particular case, that is the only case that he is legally under the Supreme Court's order permitted to try. And he couldn't, your argument taken to its logical extreme would mean that any other cases that he had pending, if they were imminent, he could go ahead and try those too. And Ms. Pugh said that is absolutely not what the Supreme Court intended. So I'd like you to speak to that. And I think that's a variation of what Justice Connors just asked you.
Certainly. And I think what the case law, you know, tells us is that a suspended or disbarred attorney stands in stark contrast to one who is merely under investigation. So under investigation versus stay, right? So I do think this really hinges on the Supreme Court's order, but I'd like to point out that this is an attorney who agreed to the terms of the suspension, right? And was forthcoming in some regard. Now, the neglect here to mention Treadwell and to specifically ask to sanction the Treadwell case, I can't speak to that.
I'm sure Ms. Pugh would take issue with your characterization of him as being forthcoming, but go ahead.
Certainly. Well, he did agree to the suspension. And I stand on the argument that he did remain duly licensed and unsuspended at this point. Now, to parse out that you're only allowed for one certain case, you know, that's the Supreme Court's order. Certainly, I can't speculate beyond that, because with his license, you know, the terms are that he still had his license, but the Supreme Court's order, I truly can't speak to that beyond, you know, what I see from the case law here. And there is some, you know, these are.
Can you look at the Gamino case, which is, I think, very definitive here. It says a counsel is not allowed to practice unless they're duly licensed and qualified. This lawyer was licensed, but was he qualified? By the suspension from the Supreme Court, how could he be qualified to practice?
No, and Justice Connors, I think that's a great point. I think that, again, a lot of speculation here. Had the Supreme Court not sanctioned that he could, you know, do this White case, this murder case? I mean, it wasn't like there was a lot of details about, you know, it was a murder case. the defendant's name. So my argument is that he was qualified enough to, you know, stay on that case. I would have to say that he was qualified enough to stay on this other murder trial as well. Now, perhaps it'd be different if he was asking, you know, to proceed on a retail theft case, but these are both murder trials. So just to that point, that would be my argument.
Ms. McGann, let me bounce back to the 651C for a moment.
Certainly.
I'm looking at my notes here, and it seems, am I correct? The first attorney was the one who filed the certificate. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then there was a second attorney who popped in who had almost no communication with the first, right?
So the second attorney, both assistant public defenders, and they, the first one, he represented him for, you know, almost, I think it was 2007 until, or 2000, whatever it was until 2017 for several years. And we had that counsel who, you know, really went through the myriad pro se petitions, reviewed them, did all of the legwork there. I did file a motion to cite additional authority, the People v. Smith case, which really speaks to this issue. So initial counsel reviewed, did all the amendments, and it was sort of ready baked with you, if you will, on a platter. And then yes, there was second counsel.
Is the motion to cite additional authority still pending?
Oh, I apologize. I should have already known that. So Smith is cited this court's opinion in Smith. So may still be pending then. So excuse me for not knowing that, if that was.
I believe it was actually.
Ms. McGann, what I'm trying to get at here, and you veered way off my question, okay?
Yeah.
My question was, it sounds like there was a second attorney who did not file a certificate, right? Yes or no?
Correct.
Okay. And that second attorney had almost no communication with the first one.
And
my question is, you seem to be relying on the fact that there is a second attorney who cleaned things up, but isn't, how is the second attorney supposed to know what the first one did? I mean, I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Oh, no, certainly are. And I think, you know, the rule does not, if you look at the plain language of Rule 651C, there's, you know, no direction or requirement for both of those attorneys to communicate. Once that certificate is filed, there's that rebuttable presumption that the pro se petitions and pleadings have been reviewed and amended and shaped. So at that point, when whatever proceedings we're at, whatever stage we're at, that second attorney can rest on that. And certainly here we have the second attorney who it's clear that he did review it all and did make sure that it was all, you know, wrapped up in a bow, because he added some exhibits just to some of the issues that were necessary, I believe.
Again, isn't a rebuttable presumption just that, something that can be rebutted by other facts? And are there some facts here that I'm sure your opponent would proffer rebutted the presumption that the second attorney was up to speed? I mean, you if there's a rebuttable presumption and the facts that are put forward rebuts that presumption, where does it leave us? Are you saying that there were no facts here that rebutted that presumption?
Yes, I don't think that that counsel petitioner provided any facts to rebut that presumption. I think that we can rely on the fact that the initial assistant public defender filed the 651C, and then the second assistant public defender argued at the motion to dismiss, and there's no indication that he did anything but argue based on all of that was contained in the petition. In fact, I think—
Well, that's just it. All that was contained in the record. It's not just the petition, it's the record as well, right?
Certainly. Yes, and I think that we even have that public defender telling the court, you know, I've reviewed all of this to make sure it's all intact. And there were, again, many more pro se pleadings that the petitioner in the interim had been filing. So I think he was doing his due diligence, that public defender, to indicate to the court that this is ready to go. There is no need for another 651C certificate because that work has already been done here. And as Smith tells us, even just, you know, from from this court's decision, that was in line with the rule, where then, you know, it doesn't remove the rebuttable presumption just because, you know, there was a 651C petition filed by one attorney and then there's the other. It certainly there we can rebut that, but I don't have anything here to present. And our argument would be that it was seamless, if you will. It took much time, but to go back and require that second assistant public defender sort of do a do-over, I mean, that would certainly be a waste of time. I think the Smith court says just in resources, because that work had already been done.
Could we talk about the right to counsel of your choice? Could you address that issue, please?
Certainly.
Right to counsel of the defendant's choice, because your opponent spent a great deal of time on that issue, and I think we can all agree that it's an important issue.
Sure. Okay, so I would say, you know, if you just look at the timeline here, petitioner was represented by Mr. Slaughter for 4 years when he made a request for a public defender. And that was March 2nd, 2004. And then there were several, you know, following court dates. I think we all acknowledge this.
Ms. McGann, as Justice DeLorde said, we've read the facts and we are very familiar with the timeline. What I'd like you to address is what happened when Judge Dernbach made Attorney Slaughter stay on the case. I saw nothing in the record that suggested that Mr. Slaughter said, you know, three other judges said that I ought to be off the case, and this defendant doesn't want me on the case. Your argument is that the defendant should have spoken up himself. I mean, he has a lawyer right there. And do you put any responsibility on the lawyer to tell the judge what had occurred on before three other judges, before it came to Judge Dernbach? Does Mr. Slaughter have any responsibility for accurately relating to Judge Dernbach what had occurred?
Sure, but I just would have to go back to the fact that post-conviction counsel shaped the argument the way that defendant, you know, presented it and, you know, did that in the most reasonable way, which was that—
Well, that goes back to my question about whether it was appropriate for him not to have amended the defendant's petition in the first place. Remember, we asked that question a few minutes ago and you said no, it was fine. But now you're saying that based on what the pro se defendant had written, then that's how he argued it. And so we're kind of going around in a circle and I'm trying to get at, do you think there was any responsibility on Mr. Slaughter to bring to the attention of Judge Dernbach that Slaughter had been fired and that Mr. Treadwell had been granted, his motion had been granted by Judge Tooman, Judge Claps, and Judge Reyna?
Certainly there may be, but we just have a record that says he wishes to withdraw and there's no indication. The defendant remains silent. That's
my question now. Right. So I'm asking, was there at that time a responsibility on Mr. Slaughter to say to speak up, so to speak, speak up on behalf of his client? You know, let's be realistic about what goes on in the courtroom. There's a client who is a young man standing there and his lawyer is there. Is there a responsibility on the part of that attorney to speak up and say to Judge Dernbach, Judge, I know you're asking me to stay on the case, but just Judges Tooman and Reyna and Clapp said that I ought to be off, and my client doesn't want me on the case. I mean, does he have I'm just asking. Yes,
yeah, certainly. And I guess my point was that I don't know what transpired between that time, because defendant petitioner did not speak up, and maybe things had changed at that point. Now, was it incumbent on the judge?
We have a transcript that tells us what took place in the courtroom. So I think we can read the transcript and see what the judge said to the lawyer and what the lawyer said to the judge. And nothing is written about what the defendant said. So my question is, since we know from the record that the defendant clearly didn't want this lawyer to represent him, is there a responsibility for Mr. Slaughter to have spoken up?
If that was still petitioner's wish, but it did not stop petitioner from making that request on those other occasions. So I guess I can only point out that this was an occasion before we have now the assigned judge, which I think was indicated to petitioner, and he remained silent, but was able to make the request beforehand. Now, was it incumbent on the judge to go back and scour the record? I'm not seeing anything presented that he would have been able to glean that there was that request. And if counsel can show otherwise or present that, certainly then. But I think the issue here is, that defendant did not make the request again, and he had made it prior.
Ms. McGann, your time is up, but let me ask you one question about the sleeping judge issue. It's your position, is it not, that the affidavits are insufficient to trigger an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, that would be our position.
And how, I'm a little skeptical of that position, because my question would be, what do the affidavits need to say to trigger an evidentiary hearing about a sleeping judge? I mean, do they need to say the judge showed up in his pajamas or something? We got, was it 2-3 people who said the judge was asleep for parts of the trial?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a great point. These are 3 affidavits that are provided by defendant's friends or family. And we don't have much fleshed out there. And I just have to point out that, the case law tells us that, a sleeping judge is unlike a judge who physically removes himself from the bench, which is then, this per se presumptive error.
But now, wouldn't that be the reason for having a hearing? I mean, that's the whole purpose of the hearing, to flesh that out. As you pointed out, if it's not fleshed out, and there are 3 affidavits that which you suggest you're inferring may be self-serving or not accurate, that's what the hearing would be designed to ferret out. Isn't that the reason for a hearing?
Sure. And I would say based on those affidavits, I don't think they warranted a hearing, because even if the judge—
That's Justice DeLorte's question. Why not? What would they need to say other than what they said to warrant a hearing?
Well, I think they would have to say that the judge left the room, because that would be, the argument here is that the judge there was some presumptive error and was not engaged in this trial. But the case law tells us that you would have to be physically absent.
So are you saying that if the judge was asleep the whole time, sleeping clearly enough that he was snoring, if he hadn't left the room, it's okay? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think we have those details in there, but certainly if there was, the indication that the judge was sleeping through the whole trial, maybe that would warrant a third stage hearing. But what we have here are, sort of elusive facts, indication that the judge was sleeping. Now, I don't know if that's someone pensive closing their eyes, perhaps, but we have only what we, see in these affidavits, again, provided by 3 individuals who are there for the defendant. And it's simply not akin to an absent judge.
Which gets back to Justice DeLorte's question of, wouldn't that warrant a hearing to let us know what really was going on? Anyway, you've answered the question. Thank you.
Ms. McGann, anything else you want to say to wrap up?
No, thank you, Your Honors. I would just rest on all the other arguments contained in our brief, and thank you.
Any other questions from the panel for the state?
No.
All right, Ms. Pugh, we're back to you. You've got 5 minutes for a reply.
Well, I'm under the impression that the justices on this panel sort of know what I'm likely to say on rebuttal, in terms of that, yes, he said he had pending matters, but he said that he was going to put them on to other people or hurry them up. I mean, there are so many things to be saying about what the responsibility in terms of counsel choice for somebody who's been in jail since he was 17 to protect his own right to counsel choice when he's surrounded by adults who have gone to law school who are doing nothing to help him. I think we all know all of that, but I did want to clear up some confusion about the second issue, which is involving People versus Smith and the 651C issue. This court did actually allow Ms. McGann's motion for to cite additional authority yesterday, and that was an Illinois Supreme Court case that that said actually that that the situation that occurred here can be okay, where there's where the first post-conviction counsel files the 651C petition, but and then is finally represented by somebody who does not file the petition. Smith said that in some circumstances that can be okay. However, it's not okay in a case like this where the 651C certificate is rebutted by the record and by the petitions. And so I'm just maintaining that Smith has no relevance to this particular case, because in Smith, that was a standalone issue about the 651C certificate. And so for all the reasons that we discussed, it's very necessary here to go forward with further hearings in order to develop the claim about whether he was suspended, about the fraud, about counsel of choice, and about sleeping, where we have to take these affidavits as true. And I don't think that we live in a country where judges can sleep during trial and it's not an error as long as they are physically present. And so for all of these reasons, would ask this court to remand for further post-conviction hearings.
Thank you. Any other questions from the panel?
No.
Hearing none, we thank counsel for their arguments on this interesting case. The court will take the matter under advisement. This concludes the arguments for today, and court staff will remove everyone from the Zoom room except for the panel members.